You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews every week with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with climate activist and writer Amy Seidel. As an ecologist, educator, and mother of two girls, Amy Seidel writes about the state of life in the age of warming. By drawing on her 20-year career studying ecology, evolution, and sustainability, her work illuminates the historical significance, impacts, and opportunities that come with climate change in the 21st century. A passionate speaker on contemporary environmental issues, Amy Seidel frequently keynotes and lectures on climate change, renewable energy, local food systems, and the emerging field of sustainability science. Her research in ecological systems and alternative energy makes her a sought-after lecturer on global warming and green design, and she emphasizes the need to innovate and build new physical infrastructures that do not rely on fossil fuels. Amy Seidel received a doctorate in biology from the University of Vermont, a master's in entomology from Colorado State University, and a Bachelor of Arts from Hampshire College. She has taught in the environmental programs at Middlebury College and UVM. She lives in a solar-powered home in Huntington, Vermont, with her husband, Daniel Goodyear, and their children. Her first book is called Early Spring, An Ecologist and Her Children Wake to a Warming World. And the most recent book is Finding Higher Ground, Adaptation in the Age of Warming. I spoke to Amy Seidel last week. I asked her to start by talking a little bit about how she opens the book, Finding Higher Ground.
The definition of adaptation that I use early in the book comes right from Darwin, And I found it quite stunning, actually, to look at it in its simple sense, which is to be suited to conditions at hand. And as those conditions change radically, as they're changing in this age of warming, it's our responsibility and our task to become better suited to these conditions. Mm-hmm. So when we look in natural environments, we see some amazing examples of adaptation, which is often co-evolutionary, where one organism and another organism have been sort of the environments for one another, and they've become so in synchrony that it's a completely beneficial relationship.
Right, like those birds that follow the birds. What are those called?
Exactly.
The little birds that are always sort of...
Yes, or the way birds sit on the backs of water buffalo, and live on their backs.
Or like pilot fish and sharks, I guess.
Yes, or pilot fish and sharks. There's so many great examples of that. And I think, if I can, in the largest framework, humans have never truly match the conditions at hand, contemporary humans. They have had other agenda that has driven how they have lived in the landscape. So now we have the opportunity, and it's a first opportunity ever in human civilization, to adapt to radically changing conditions so that our own existence and persistence is assured. Mm-hmm. And I think that this notion of adaptation has great, great consequence, and yet if we look at that definition from Darwin, we realize it has directionality, and we can see it in natural systems right away. Mm-hmm. We can see adaptation taking place in these natural systems because of climate change, and now the question is, how do we do it in our own landscapes and in our own culture?
Right, and the natural systems, the plants and the animals, are not pointing fingers and saying, who created this problem? It's just evolution to them, and in a sense, it's the next step in our evolution as well. It's funny because I hadn't thought about that before I read this book, but it really is. It's just the next step in our evolution. If you set aside the blame and solutions and causes, right?
That's right, and I love how you said that, you know, set aside the blame, because it's meant to come across without judgment. certainly we've arrived in this age of warming because of our industrial activity, really, over the last 200, 300 years. But when we set about that industrial era, we didn't, you know, the unintended consequence is now a warmed atmosphere and, with high concentrations of carbon. Mm-hmm. Now that we know that's true and we have great data to support that, the question is, how do we advance from here? What's the next evolutionary step for culture? Not to sort of spend our time blaming the fact that this consequence arose. At the same time, we know that furthering that problem is becoming more and more, anathema and immoral even because of the repercussions of this changed atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So I think that we are sort of at a pivot point where it is important to move forward without judgment, and yet we can't continue to exacerbate knowing the fallout and the outcome of a warming planet.
Right. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about why you wrote the book.
Yeah.
Or how you came to decide that you were going to actually put all these thoughts into a book.
Well, my background is as an ecologist and an evolutionary biologist, and so my research has always been in how organisms are suited and adapt and evolve in landscapes, especially landscapes that are being changed by climate change, alpine landscapes in particular. And so I wrote a first book called Early Spring, An Ecologist and Her Children Wake to a Warming World, about my own realization of climate change in a very local landscape. Mm-hmm. So we're talking today in Vermont, and I chose the New England landscape as the one to describe this phenomenon in place, because there's still a reaction to climate change in America, which is it exists somewhere else. It exists in the Arctic mm-hmm. or in the Polynesian Islands. It's not here. Even some people in America might think it's not where we live in the middle of the country. It's happening on the coasts, where there are hurricanes. Well, that's all changing, and I meant to help that change of perception occur by writing a book about how my own landscape in New England was changing. Mm-hmm. As I came to the end of that project and the end of the writing, I realized that, having my readers understand these signs and realize them in the quotidian nature of their lives and the everyday circumstances of when the seasons arrive and when the robins sing, when the cardinal sings, etc., was not enough. I needed to, and I wanted to, imbue them with hope and possibility of adapting. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of, as much as nonfiction, creative nonfiction can have a sequel, this book, Finding Higher Ground, is really the sequel mm-hmm. to Early Spring, because I think it brings my readers into this next phase of thinking about climate change, which is a very hopeful and optimistic phase, but one that is very pragmatic at the same time.
Right.
And I think personalized as well.
Which is really helpful, because I think people, even if they understand that it's happening locally, there's this sense of, okay, what do I do about it? What do I personally do about this? Okay, I'll drive my car less. I'll try to ride bikes in the summertime, So it was very practical and very helpful.
Yes.
For readers.
It was meant to be, that, and at the same time to really open up the fact that this is historic. Mm-hmm. This is geologic. Mm-hmm. It's historic like the Civil War was historic, meaning we've come to a place culturally where we realize our actions are no longer suited to this society. Mm-hmm. We can no longer, if we were in the Civil War era, oblige ourselves of slavery, of enslaving another human being. 50 years earlier, that was okay. Now it's no longer. And so we had, Jefferson and others standing up and saying, this is not okay.
Right, right.
And ultimately, we had the rise of the philosophy of pragmatism in America. Oliver Wendell Holmes and William James writing about, actually after the Civil War, why that was an immoral behavior. Mm-hmm. And I think so even though the book is about personal action, it's about personal action the way ending slavery was about personal action you know, in the 1860s. We can no longer do these activities as a society because it's not right any longer, and we have to find new ways of being.
Right.
And so, again, I think it's important to see how that action rests in the individual, but it's reflective of great social change that's also happening.
Okay. I have to just mention that I loved the part of the book where you reminded me, I had sort of forgotten, that Vermont actually abolished slavery in 1777, and stuck with it in 1791 when we rejoined the Union, and it was like, yay!
Wasn't that? I love discovering that too, because it shows that this kind of progressive thinking around social change does exist historically, and we can be that bellwether again. Mm-hmm. You know, we can be that leader by saying we're going to be carbon-free energy, we're going to be nuclear and carbon-free energy. Because of what's happening with Yankee Nuclear in our state. Mm-hmm. You know, we can lead that way, and the others will follow if we set the example.
Right. In the book, before you talk about humans and climate change, you spend some time explaining a bit about the plant and animal worlds and how they've adapted to other outside influences that demanded change of habit. Mm-hmm. And in that part of the book, you talk about a man named Stan Bouton, is that how you say his name?
Yeah.
Who works with squirrels. He's been studying the habits of squirrels for over 20 years. So now he has this really impressive amount of data, which was interesting to read about. And I was curious if he originally set out to look at their reactions to climate change, or was his work just sort of a happy coincidence for climate scientists?
Yeah,
now?
It was the latter, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
This man is really, he's a geneticist, he's a mammalogist, and he's really interested in how, as the age of genetics becomes so much more sophisticated, we can tie particular gene regions to particular behaviors, you know, mm-hmm. so that we can say, you know, just like we can do with a breast cancer gene in human populations now that we've coded the entire human genome. So he said about 25 years ago to understand this population of squirrels in the Yukon, and that population was, its habitat was seeing tremendous change because it's northern latitude habitat because of climate change. The Arctic and northern latitudes are warming much more rapidly mm-hmm. than mid and temperate regions. And because he had these great genetics and pretty much understood the whole genealogy of, you know, 20 years of squirrel population, he could show that particular behaviors that suited these changing conditions were heritable. So females who made it earlier, who raised their pups earlier, who took advantage now of earlier cone fall from these pine trees, did much better and were more fit, and their offspring did better, just like natural selection foretells, and they were advancing, that genotype was advancing in the population. So it was it's a great study because it shows that there's a very, very rapid evolution to these landscape level changes that are genetic, mm-hmm. you know, and that's really the difference. Because if we think about adaptation, some people might think, oh, I can adjust to that, mm-hmm. you know, and we think about that sort of using the term in a vernacular sense in human culture. But in biological systems, we think of it being a genetic change, something that can be inherited. Mm-hmm. And that's what Bouton showed, was that, you know, all of these adjustments to an earlier spring, to warming conditions, to changing in foodstuffs, had a genetic basis in squirrels.
You have this quote in here. You talk about culture being a selective agent. Yes, culture itself is a selective agent. Okay, so through technologies and cultural practices, we realize culture itself can be a selective agent. And you gave examples such as medicine and food storage. And so it's wonderful because it's gotten us so far. But on the other hand, our culture sometimes slows us down in doing what we need to do. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a kind of a thorny kernel in how human cultures will adapt. So if we think of ourselves as a human culture, you know, 6,000 years ago, there was a time where we decided to herd cattle, right? And shortly thereafter, we began to drink the milk of these cattle we were domesticating. Well, and this happened around the world, in Africa, in the African continent, in the European continent, so it wasn't happening in just one place, people adapted or evolution occurred by selection favoring individuals who could digest milk. So prior to 6,000 years, we were not milk-drinking species. You know, we were hunters and gatherers.
Not cow milk-drinking.
Not cow milk-drinking anyway, exactly. And so as that cultural idea of let's herd animals and now let's drink their milk, well, those individuals in our society that can break down this milk product using lactase enzymes, etc., were then favored, and in time, the populations of humans that could drink milk were those that survived because it was such a nutrient-rich source of food. So that was that's a case where our cultural choice, i.e. to herd animals, resulted in real biological evolution in our bodies. Mm-hmm. Now, because we're pretty buffered from, you know, the strength of natural selecting working on our systems, because we can store foods, because we have medicines, we have shelters, it may be that culture is selecting, is working through different media than our genes. Mm-hmm. So most social scientists would say that it's working through learning, or how we pass on knowledge, or how we communicate. That's the way in which we're advancing and evolving culturally. We're not really evolving biologically. Mm-hmm. So the case of the red squirrel is that the squirrel is definitely advancing biologically, and we see biological evolution there. As we look in human populations and their response to climate change, it will be a cultural response. What's our new innovation? What are the new tools? How are we communicating these ideas? How are we preparing for disaster? Those are the ways in which we'll measure cultural evolution in response to climate change.
Right. Well, I wonder if this might be a good time for you to read those couple pages
of
the book. And the book is Finding Higher Ground, Adaptation in the Age of Warming, and it's published by Beacon Press.
When I ponder adaptation, my thoughts unintentionally drift to the larvae of the hawk moth, a tropical insect. Most tropical moths and butterflies are known for their iridescent colors and bird-sized wings. The morpho butterfly flashes a gorgeous spectrum of blue, violet, and aquamarine, shimmering like liquid glass and edged in a silvery brown. But it is the wingless larvae of the hawk moth that astonishes me. At first, the caterpillar appears indistinct, an ordinary ivy-green body with a slender, muted green head that extends in one direction, while its similarly green tail widens in another. When a predator approaches, everything changes. Its tail expands, fills with air, and widens into the shape of a snake's head. Folds of skin mimic a snake's gaping, ominous mouth, and black spots outlined in white with yellow edges look just like a snake's pupils and menacing wide-eyed stare. There is even a slight crease between the two eyes, imitating the indentation of a reptilian skull, an impressive feat for an animal that has no bones or cartilage at all. The hawk moth's near-perfect mimicry elicits the kind of awe I feel when I see a young violinist play a complicated piece, except in this case, it's natural selection, not talent and hard work, that has fashioned the tissue of a caterpillar to look, with exacting detail, like the predator of the very animals that eat it. But natural selection does not result in perfection, though it is hard to not see the near faultless match of the caterpillar's tail and snake's eyes, a form of it. Rather, selection works to help organisms adapt to local conditions. As conditions change, snake predators included, corresponding changes in the organisms affected by them change too. My amazement with adaptation does not stop at caterpillars disguising themselves as snakes. Have you seen the orchid mantis with pink legs? It just so resembles the Asian orchids it lives on that only on close inspection of its silky petals, floral pink with two cerulean dashes, do I see the mantis's eyes blinking. These marvels of nature and evolution do not end with insects. The outrageous and at times freakish adaptations of thousands of organisms, the head of the hammerhead shark, the luminous blue of a jay's wing, the penny-sized opossum born hairless, clutching its mother's nipple for 6 weeks, are all testaments of evolution to the infinite tinkering of biology and the constant tuning of organisms to shifting conditions.
Thank you very much for reading that.
My pleasure.
I love the description of the hawk moth's caterpillar, and I didn't know that about the caterpillars. Like I've read enough magic school bus to know that the actual moths have the eyes on them.
Yes, right.
And those look more like owls. Is that right?
Yeah,
are they
that's
supposed to
right.
look like owls.
Exactly.
When the wings are open?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I loved that description, and it just boggles my mind to think that evolution and that biology must be just thousands and thousands of years for this sort of change to develop. Is that right? Or
In some cases, in other cases it's more rapid. But the kind of fine tuning that I describe there, is hypothesized to have taken, millennia, let's just say, and nobody really, I don't know, maybe some people have tried to calculate how long it takes. There's a man named Paul Ehrlich, who's a wonderful, really a sort of a father of advanced biology, is living today, he's at Stanford University, and he coined the term coevolution in the 1960s, and he did it because of butterflies. He is a butterfly ecologist, and he talks about it being reciprocal exchange. Mm. So as soon as there's a change in the caterpillar, then the snake predator changes somewhat, and then the caterpillar has to change, and it goes back and forth and back and forth infinitely in time.
Yeah.
And it happens in less clearly illustrative moments too, like it happens chemically. Mm-hmm. So a plant will come up with some novel chemical, speaking teleologically, but just randomly a mutation, and then the thing that eats it will come up with a way to digest it.
Yeah.
And then another more potent chemical and another way to digest it. And so it's happening invisibly, mm-hmm. as much as it's happening visibly, like I describe.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about the pitcher plants in the book too, and that is so fascinating, the way that the plant actually eats the animals in those cases.
Exactly.
With the enzymes.
Well, it's so fun to have you as a reader pick up on those stories for their own sake, as well as for how I'm trying to, make this argument about evolution, because it's so great for us to go back to these stories. They're really stories. Mm. They're really narratives, natural history narratives of the amazing quality and the intricacy and the abilities of natural systems and their diversity. Mm-hmm. I ask my readers to sort of call upon that wonder a bit, because it does have an infinite quality to it, and that's what we could draw on when we think of our own innovation. Mm-hmm. Right, this evolutionary innovation is so plentiful.
Mm-hmm.
It's immeasurable. That's how plentiful it is. And we've barely scratched the surface of how we could use those examples in our own ways of adapting to landscapes,
mm-hmm.
and building and designing a life that is far more sustainable.
And planning a future in which we still exist.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the human reaction to climate change. You, for example, you live in a solar and wind-powered house that you talk about a bit in the book. At one point in Finding Higher Ground, you mentioned that one upside to this is that the power doesn't fail, which I thought was a biggie in Vermont. Anyway, I was just wondering if you can talk a little bit about living in a solar and wind-powered house and a few of the characteristics or quirks of living in your house.
Yeah. Well, I brought that example up in the book because I want to inspire my readers to think how differently we could be living.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to talk about experimentation in this time, because this is a time where we re-examine an entire way of living, which is a life based in fossil fuels. And we know now this unintended consequence exists, so we have to begin experimenting with alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
The same way we experimented with different foodstuffs at different times culturally, or different ways of manufacturing, or even different energy systems in the past, from wood to steam to oil in our past. So I bring that story up because it's clumsy right now. I do live off the grid, but it's clumsy. It's not as sophisticated or elegant as it will become,
mm-hmm.
and yet it's on the trajectory to being that way. It's not steeped in what we now realize is really negative. It's not run on fossil fuels, and yet it's just emerging into this next stage of what would be really a revolution in energy that we'll see in human civilization. So, for instance, some of the solar panels on our roof come from my father-in-law, who used them to run fans to keep his llamas cool when he was raising llamas.
Oh, wow.
So just think about how that in time will be describing, you know, a very sort of luxurious use of energy to keep, you know, a South American animal cool in a Pennsylvania countryside. Well, once the llamas were no longer being raised, he gave us all his solar panels, and now we run a house in a northern latitude on them.
I'm wondering how long ago he was doing that.
He did that for about 10 years, and about 5 years ago he gave us those solar panels. Mm-hmm. We had some panels on already, but the addition of his panels allowed us almost to be 100% running on solar energy.
Okay.
The other thing about solar power, which is something I'm always telling my students, is that we have not realized yet how super abundant the sun is in our lives. Mm. So in 1 hour, the amount of photons hitting the Earth's surface could power the world's economy for a year. 1 hour of sun. Just another example of the superabundance. 1 billion tons of coal fed into a furnace somehow, instantaneously, is 1 second of the sun's output. So it's a phenomenal amount of power and energy that we have yet to understand how to capture. And so it really, when I know those physical realities, I start to want to experiment with how to capture them. And that's what living in a solar-powered home allows me to do. How do I make this experiment work with early technology, albeit still unsophisticated, pretty clumsy, and yet doable?
And changing fast, right?
And changing very, very fast.
Right.
But, you know, doable. So I live in a place that gets 90 days of sun a year. I used to live in Wyoming that gets 330. So on a quarter of the amount of sun, I'm still experimenting and succeeding with technologies that are really going to be seen as kind of like, using an iron that we used to put on the stove to iron, you know, something really unsophisticated if we think about a 19th century practice and how far evolved we've come, or the way in which we use iPods before we had party line telephones. I mean, that's what I foresee in the coming decade and two around solar energy. But even still, it gives me the experience to talk about the future while I experiment right now, and I wean myself from fossil fuels, and I get to talk about how that feels.
Yeah.
I get to reflect on not only having power when the grid goes down, but how I can become a model and an island, a resource when the grid goes down for other people.
Right.
Because I have chosen now to try to get my energy from the sun.
Yeah. Is it all very self directed? I mean, do you understand how it all works, and are you sort of a hands-on maintenance person for your own stuff?
I do understand how things work, but I'm also married to somebody who we call in the household the chief engineer. And he's not an engineer, but he should have been. In his next life, he will be, probably. But it's pretty simple, actually, and it's very easy to monitor. My children, my young girls, can definitely monitor the system. As important is the culture in the household of never wasting power. Because we know on a bright, sunny day that it's money in the bank. The batteries are being charged. We have lots of power. You can do any amount of washing you want. And if we have a period of cold, rainy days, we're much more conservative.
Right.
And so we live with, even though it's still kind of invisible, we live understanding how much energy the house holds.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a different perception, but one that most people will come to understand in the next 10 years.
Right. The way that, maybe not in every state, but certainly in Vermont, everybody recycles now. And when it first was being suggested, it's like, what? I have to do what? I have to separate these things into different boxes. I can't just throw them out anymore.
That's right.
Right.
It's a new ethos. And that ethos is arising, and it will arise around energy too, especially if we undertake the experiment to be nuclear-free and carbon-free, because we'll probably be limited in electricity, and yet for the right reason.
Right.
You know.
Right. I want to talk a little bit about the understanding that this exists, and the fact that there are non-believers, and the fact that even the average American citizen might not quite know that much about it yet. And if climate activists have ideas about how to bring all these people together to have a rational conversation and understand that things are changing and what your perspective is on that.
Well, this is a big question.
Yes.
And we are very polarized in America around
everything.
Right, exactly. Everything, the debt ceiling to climate change. I was talking with somebody the other day and he said, you know, there are 24 political parties in India and they all believe in climate change and the science and the consensus of the science. So I think that's important, that's sobering to us in America to realize how divisive this has become when really the rest of the world, not only India, but the rest of the world wholeheartedly accepts the consensus, the scientific consensus. So one is to acknowledge that we've had professional doubters and naysayers and skeptics funded by predominantly the fossil fuel industry to cast doubt. And that casting of doubt has been successful. They've used legal means, they've used lobbying means, very well-funded campaigns to secure the proceeds that come from maintaining a fossil fuel society. And we need to be transparent about that and acknowledge that that contingent exists.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, if you look at the polls, more than usually, between 50 and 60%, depending on the state of the economy, believe that climate change is a human-induced event. Some members of the society feel that aren't ready to accept that at all, but most believe that that's true. And then you have a portion of America they call the alarmists, and a portion of America that are the highly skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what polarizes that middle,
mm-hmm.
are those extremes. So the question is how to move forward in a polarized and divisive society around really the science and the doubt that's been cast. And my feeling is that there are two ways to do it. One is to, just as we did with the Civil War and ultimately with the civil rights, is to garner a very, very vocal minority who's willing to continue the conversation and to educate and be out there speaking. And I see myself as part of that minority.
Mm-hmm.
Just as, you know, again, I keep referring to these other social movements. We had leaders in the women's movement, in the, you know, the equitable workday movement, 8 hours a day, or civil rights to stand up. We never had a majority. We had a vocal minority that pressed our governments and our court system to pass legislation that was in keeping with those ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what will happen with climate change, I think, in time. The second is to find alternative conversations where those people, that part of the population that doesn't believe in the science yet or is highly skeptical, can buy into other activities that further our adaptation to climate change.
Such as adaptation as a conversation.
Such as adaptation. And this may be an opportunity, especially during the year of 2011 when we saw extreme weather events in the country. We saw extreme flooding across the country in this April and May of 2011. We saw incredible hurricane and tornado damage in the summer and fall. Hurricane Irene, Lee, etc. We saw wildfires across the Southwest that had never been seen before. Heat waves where 34 states broke records for the numbers of day above 90 and 100 degrees. People feel this now. After 2011, certainly Hurricane Katrina in 2005, more regionally, but now, after 2011, people realize the weather's changing.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is how to make themselves less vulnerable.
Right.
Whether it's human-induced or whether it's a natural event is almost not an issue for them. It's how to be less vulnerable,
right,
and how to gain resilience, how to build our bridges differently, how to build our roads differently, what size the culverts should be. And this is an opportunity to kind of leapfrog over that polarized moment in history into a question of adaptation.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in the book that over 60% of the world's population lives along coastlines or in coastal areas.
That's correct.
So, and that made me think about Irene, which was a tropical storm when it got to Vermont, and how much damage it did here. So just speaking in terms of Vermont, and what people can do to make themselves less vulnerable if they live perhaps along a river, And you mentioned bridges just now, but can we talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. Well, this is where the pragmatics come right at hand, right? So there's our reacting to crisis and how we get through crisis, and then there's our responding to the predictions at hand,
right,
and the frequency of these crises occurring. So right now, the state of Vermont is still in crisis, and it's reacting, and it's saying, how do we take care of these disaster victims? How do we supply for them? How do we make sure the kids are in school, etc.? But behind that conversation is, where do we build now?
Mm-hmm.
And right, how do we ensure that the property that people own that is very likely to be flooded again is either not built on or they are recompensed mm-hmm. for that property and they move elsewhere, mm-hmm. including our state offices, which is on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy to hear Governor Shumlin say it is under review whether or not the state offices will stay in Waterbury because of their proximity to the Winooski River and their propensity to flood.
Mm-hmm.
And I
mm-hmm.
think that that is a brave and pragmatic framing and really responsive framing to this question. And that's what it means for the individuals, too, sometimes, is should we rebuild here, like New Orleans, except along the Mad River?
Mm-hmm.
Is this the place where we should farm in the Intervale? Should we continue to incubate young farmers in an area that has rich soil, but where you lose and are likely to lose your crops when these events happen?
Mm-hmm.
We've had 2 1-in-500-year flood events in the last decade here in Vermont. In New Hampshire, parts of New Hampshire has seen 5
wow.
in a decade. So, you know, the frequency is forcing us to be brave and courageous about really new planning
mm-hmm.
and new design of where we put our infrastructure and true limitation. Perhaps legislative limitations that say you cannot build in now a 500-year floodplain. You can't build there.
Yeah. Right. And the sort of emergency sense at this time of getting roads built so that people can be back on their commutes and getting to where they need to go seems at odds with the need to think about this and plan well.
And yet, you know, the person who's actually a conservative fiscal person who says we're going to spend, you know, several million dollars to put this road in, but another event will lose all that investment,
right,
realizes how faulty that reasoning
right.
is.
Okay.
And so the better approach is to go back to our town plans and to our state governments that help us with that town planning and say, this is the predicted, these are the predicted changes for you. For instance, we're going to see 30% more rainfall, precipitation generally, in Vermont by 2050. And that's a prediction for most climate models, that climate models make for our region. That precipitation is going to come in deluge events, more than 2 to 4 inches in 24 hours. So if that's the prediction, how does your infrastructure, how well will it withstand that change?
Mm-hmm.
And we need to look at our town plans and begin to accommodate that frequency of rain in our bridges and our roads and where we allow people to build.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to go back with a new lens
mm-hmm.
to these planning documents. And in our state governments, we need them to fund us while we begin these infrastructural changes at the very least.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have to think, where's our food going to come from? You know, where's our, how about water? We have to be better prepared for disaster, for islands of support that people can rely on, because this is a transition that will take a long time ultimately to complete. And we'll get to a transformative place, which I vision to be a fossil-free world that is imbued with sustainable principles. Right now, we are steeped in fossil fuel. You know, maybe 3% of our energies come from renewables.
Yeah.
So that's a big
that's
bridge
a lot
to
of work
cross.
To do.
That's a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
But it's the post-industrial revolution that we're embarking on.
Mm-hmm.
And when the crisis happens, we realize very clearly that we better get going.
Mm-hmm. You write in the book about a friend who's growing rice, talking about experimenting with new ideas, growing rice in Vermont. Why? I mean, and you say that a lot of people are experimenting with growing rice in Vermont. So why growing rice?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like can you really run a house on solar energy in Vermont? When you hear rice in Vermont, you think, that just doesn't make sense. Right, you know, we grow corn, and we grow hay, and we grow, you know, tomatoes. But people who get these climate predictions are thinking more water, warmer conditions, more standing water. How can I benefit from those conditions and not just buffer myself against their adverse effect?
Right.
And so people like Ben Falk and others now who are actually growing down in the Champlain Valley, Ben grows up in Moortown, have put in these ponds and done a lot of horticultural work so that varieties of rice are chosen that are best suited to the climate and the climate as it's going to change, and are able to capture these deluge events, and rice do really, really well. If you also think about rice as a highly nutritive source of food and a simultaneous trajectory to eat more locally, we see that we'd be lacking a nutritive protein like rice if we didn't grow it here, mm-hmm. you know, and if we really tried to keep ourselves on a local diet. So growing rice expands that local diet to a nutritive food that can take advantage of these changing conditions. And after the storm and the Mad River and Moortown area flooded terribly, Moortown Center, I think, just took a brunt of things.
Yeah.
Ben Falk, the person I write about in the book, sent out a video of what the water looked like on his farm. And it was not brown and full of silt and eroded. It had passed through a series of swales and ponds and had been captured on his landscape.
Because he built it that way.
He built it that way.
Right.
He engineered his agriculture to benefit from an event like Hurricane Irene, Tropical mm-hmm. Storm Irene.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of design, whether we think about specifically about rice or just its perspective and its design sensibility,
mm-hmm.
that's the kind of innovation we need.
Mm-hmm.
How do we take these extreme events or even these trends of events and redesign our food systems, the way we live, the way we build, the way we build our roads, to be more coupled, to be better suited to the conditions than we do now?
Yeah.
To be driven by them instead of some other notions like, you know, we want people to get to live wherever they want to, a private property directive, something like that. It needs to be, this new design is about designing so that it's in synchrony with environments, and not, and that's the priority.
Mm-hmm. And not just stocking up on what you think you might need in the next several years if things go, you know.
Well, we know that is so highly individualistic,
yeah.
in a time that would be rife with chaos and crisis, that it's no solution at all.
Right.
And so it has to be communitarian. And that's where Bill McKibben's writing and his writing on local economies really dovetails with what I'm saying with adaptation, and that is, how do we build durable communities around these ideas of design so that they're resilient, like mm-hmm. Ben Falk's rice paddies are resilient in a time of flooding, and that everybody finds a measure of security, not just the individual who, you know, put a rice paddy on his or her landscape, but the community finds itself, okay, we're buffered against, we're prepared for, and we're actually redesigning the way we live so that we can persist in this age of warming. And that's ultimately where I get to in the book. After I introduce all these characters and narrate the stories, this is what I want my readers to leave with, which
right.
is, we can persist. This is an opportunity. It's going to take time, but if we start in, we have great metaphor and information around us
mm-hmm.
to design our lives differently.
I'm wondering if people judge you more closely since you wrote the book. And specifically, I have this vision in my head of you grocery shopping and people looking in your cart and trying to...
Well, as I was saying to you earlier, I teach a class with 280 students,
yeah.
and so almost invariably somebody's at the supermarket who I just instructed. But I think that rather than feeling ourselves hypocrites, we feel ourselves sort of communally complicit. Right? Again, this is the non-judgmental view of being alive now in a culture that needs to radically change.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, I still have to drive my car. I still want to see my family in Colorado, and that usually means a plane trip. And yet, where are the places where I can alleviate that complicity and move in the direction which is real transformative change? You know, getting our energy from the sun, eating foods that are not sort of grown in the fossil fuel industry, developing community relationships that I rely on when there's crisis, that Vermont has shown extraordinary capacity for in this last storm events that we've seen. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's true, I still have the same patterns that others have, like, I want a banana, you know, or, you know, occasionally I'd like to have a mango. And yet, when we reach for it, not unlike the person in 1860 who reached for the cotton that came from a slaved plantation, we say, maybe not today, mm-hmm. or maybe less frequently, mm-hmm. or maybe, you know, I buy solar panels instead of buying a brand new car. And this is how we alleviate the complicity and we begin the transition towards a very changed society.
You have this wonderful quote in the book that I think is relevant to what you're just saying. You say, we cannot be perfect, but we can be honest. The truth is, it is impossible to be completely self-reliant and live a contemporary life. But a perfect approach is at this time not the goal. A transparent one is. I thought that was really, really well put, and also sort of takes the heat off a little bit. It's just like, do what you can and try to be cognizant of all of this and don't try to be perfect all at once. But, you know, think about these things and encourage your community to think about these things.
Exactly. So, exactly.
I want to talk a little bit about writing. You and I met at the Vermont Studio Center in 2010 when you were working on this book. And I'm wondering, as a writer, if you can speak to writing in a retreat setting, trying to write in a retreat setting.
Well, the Vermont Studio Center was such a perfect occasion for this book, and it was wonderful to, you know, gain friends like and friendships the way, like the one you and I have. There's something, and I've only had the fortune to be at two retreats, writing retreats, but I'm due for another one, where as a writer you're always trying to find the spaciousness around ideas that come at you every day, and yet you either don't have the time to write down or you just don't have the moment to chase down. You know, mm-hmm. it takes reflection. And so to give yourself a week where your only task is to chase those ideas and follow them through and then try to find the words that best enunciate to them so they sing, mm-hmm. it's a glorious thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm just, as I'm talking to you, it's like, it's an ecstatic moment for me. And that's why I write, mm-hmm. because I get those moments in my life where all of that idea, the words behind it, the place it might lead some other person to think, comes together. Mm-hmm. And a retreat gives you so much time, so much spaciousness to make that your only task.
Right.
So it's fortune, real fortune, to have that space. And whether you're a writer or an artist or somebody else who wants to, again, get to the bone, the tenderness. I think Annie Proulx says something like, we get to that place where it's sweetest. Mm-hmm. She calls it the sweetest space, near the bone. You know, that's what retreats allow us to do, is unfold the layers and layers of complicated life that we live in, mm-hmm. and get down to these essences of meaning and poetry and communication, right? We've said the word community, but communication, where you're sharing these ideas in their ripeness. They become ripe. Anyway, that's what I got to do there. Yeah. And I got to finish this project, which otherwise I was just, you know, stealing moments here and there, mm-hmm. to try to complete.
What are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on a couple of things. I'm working on a book for children, actually, that the title is When Lilacs Bloom. And it's a narrative piece, fictional piece, for young children, ages, you know, average of 10, to get these ideas into their heads, mm-hmm. and to bring them both information and promise, mm-hmm. and to instill in them the opportunity they have as this generation that is coming up, to be our partners. So not to make it scary, to not to make it too factual, mm-hmm. but to rest it in history and in narrative. So I'm working on that right now, on a manuscript. And then I'm working on a new book, which may either be another sequel to Finding Higher Ground in that non-fictional sense, a book that's about abundance, actually. And so you can see that my writing about the environment tends not to be doom and gloom, mm-hmm. or about scarcity, even though I recognize that there are real problems and there's finiteness. I am very challenged to portray the human predicament as one that has just not found the right design nor these places of abundance. Mm-hmm. And so I want to talk about that. And I want to inspire people to find, and when I say abundance, I know that seems sort of almost theoretical and abstract, but we're talking in the month of September, and you know, if I leave my garden right now and there's a frost coming, I can't believe how much can be grown in, you know, a quarter of an acre that is so abundant right now. I could feed myself if I had the time for months and months.
Yeah.
So why does that happen in nature? And how can we become tuned in to these, what I think of as threads of abundance, like the amount of sun hitting the Earth's surface, like the amount of apples a single tree can produce, mm-hmm. like the number of seeds from a single sunflower that was planted from one seed. Mm-hmm. I'm really interested in illuminating that nature is abundant and that we need to find ways to align ourselves to those abundant threads differently than we have in the past.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that sounds really
so anyway, yeah, that's
a quarter acre is a pretty big garden though.
I know, and I don't really mean all in garden. I mean a quarter of an acre backyard, you know, a third of which is in garden. Okay. So it's actually more like a 12th of an acre.
Well, I just have one last question. What advice do you have for writers whose work encompasses an academic discipline, you know, such as climate change or geology or math, mm-hmm. and they're writing for a wider audience that may or may not have studied that discipline lately, an audience like me that has to draw on Magic School Bus?
Well, I love Magic School Bus. I read it all the time, and I watch the show, and I think it has... Isn't it wonderful when you see media that's geared to children, mm-hmm. maybe children watching it with their parents, mm-hmm. and the parents are excited about it on another level?
Right.
Right?
I remember this.
Because, you know, we're fed so much information, but we don't always use it. Mm-hmm. Those are muscles we need to go back and understand again. You know, like if I went back and sat in on a history course right now, I would get so much out of it because I want to know a history as a context for these ideas that I'm thinking
right
today.
Right.
So I guess my advice is to think about how have these scientific ideas already come to the reader in her educational past or in public discourse right now, mm-hmm. and make them applicable to her life, you know? Mm-hmm. So when I talk about climate change, it's and I say, you know, lilacs are blooming differently, a lot of people will say, absolutely, I have that experience.
Right.
Almost every household grows lilacs.
Yeah.
Or if I say something about a robin singing, you know, versus, say, a songbird that is far less conspicuous.
Right.
And yet, at the same time, the subtext for me is I want to see greater scientific literacy in the American public. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that it's important for us to, as these scientific and technological questions come at us, for us to have a basis of understanding that makes us informed enough to make decisions around technology, whether it's medical technology or technology that has perhaps some negative side, new nuclear technology. So just like when I'm teaching a big class, I hit both where I know it's going to land safely and where I'm going to challenge my reader to say, I'm going to look that up.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to actually go and look at what a hawk moth looks like now, or I'm going to look up evolution as a definition or coevolution, right? So I try to provide that tension for mm-hmm. the reader, bring them someplace and actually make it, oh yeah, I do remember that.
Well, great. Amy, thank you so much for talking to me today.
It has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Amy Seidel. You can learn more about her work at her website, amyseidel.com, and her last name is spelled S-E-I-D-L. Today's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Amy Seidel. First, read over this passage from her book, Finding Higher Ground, which I will also write out on my podcast site. Peer into the natural world, one close at hand. Perhaps it is a city park whose paths are lined with oak or maple trees planted in the 19th century. Or maybe you are fortunate enough to walk in a remnant prairie with freshwater kettle ponds and migratory ducks. Or an old-growth forest with trees whose gigantic trunks and canopies house thousands of species. Maybe you are walking in your own backyard, traversing an enclosed space that you've filled with daylilies, climbing roses, and garden beds filled with vegetables. All these places, the ones intended as sanctuary or refuge, the ones cultivated by gardeners, the wild places with no cultivators or patrons, all are experiencing the agitation of change. That, again, is an excerpt of Amy Seidel's book, Finding Higher Ground. So having read that passage, follow Amy's advice, peer out at the natural world, whichever one you find inspiring or, as Amy says, close at hand, and consider what you see and the adaptive realities that exist there. Now write about what you've noticed and your reactions to these observations. Were you surprised, awed, worried, possibly impressed? Describe the changing world as you witness it and the adaptation represented in what you've seen, and then describe how it moves you. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please do remember that this station is here thanks to community, support, and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you are listening to The Radiator. 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.